morning, Horace and Steve. Today we're going to start by talking about lithium versus hydrogen for EV batteries. So Horace, set the stage.
So what prompted this was that we just heard that Toyota is going to do a big push with, well, not big push necessarily, but we know they're going to roll out a hydrogen vehicle next year. This has been rumored for a while, but it's actually made official yesterday with a press release. And the thing is, with what we've heard so far with hydrogen is a lot of promise, but we haven't heard much about commercialization. We've heard quite a bit about commercializing battery-powered vehicles, obviously with Tesla being a real phenomenon. And this is interesting for a couple of reasons. Technically, it's interesting, but there's some that technology core, it might develop into a disruption. So we never quite know which technology core ends up that way, because that's the magic of and not science of analyzing business. So what I wanted to do is debate, or that's not the right word, to discuss the merits of either technology from technical and business points of view. The what's interesting to me about hydrogen also is that we have, so let's begin with this. It has quite a lot of history as a fuel technology, although it's not probably better thought of as a battery in itself. Through a fuel cell, there's no combustion of hydrogen. There's only a chemical process. So what I'm saying is, we can discuss the technology merits, but we can also discuss the implications in the way this might get embraced by different players. To set the stage, Toyota is not the first to go to market with this technology. We also had Honda in the United States with a product called the Clarity, launched a few years ago. So, why don't we start with Steve? You walk us through how would hydrogen be used? What are the efficiencies associated with its use as a carrier of energy, if you will?
Oh, okay. So, you know, there are a couple of ways to look at this. So I'll start and just mention a few numbers and ratios, and then go from there. So when you look at, so you're absolutely right. It's probably best to look at it as a storage media, because the good news is there's a lot of hydrogen in the universe. And in fact, you know, even on Earth, there's a lot. You're roughly 10% hydrogen. So if you can only get it out. The problem is what you need is hydrogen is a gas, and that's very, very rare on Earth. It just rarely occurs. Assuming you can get that, so to turn it into a gas takes a lot of energy, typically about 1.6 times the energy that you can get out of it. So there's, you know, there's a loss associated with it. The two main ways of getting it, electrolysis is what you did as a kid when you put a battery in water, or you put, you know, two wires in water and watch the little bubbles, hydrogen coming on one side and oxygen coming on the other. The more practical way, economically at least, is to use natural gas. There's a process associated with that that takes a little bit less energy and a lot less money.
That would be methane converted to...
Yeah, it's called methane reformation. And that... this is one thing that the petrochemical companies are really hot on. That almost all of the industrial hydrogen in the world is produced this way. And
what are the byproducts? Would there be CO2?
Yeah, CO2 is a byproduct, and it's fairly at the point where it's created like that. In theory, you could recover it, but sequestering it and storing it and handling it is still very difficult. The coal industries receive, you know, like billions of dollars of research money to look into that. That's still a problem. So in its present form, it can be thought of as CO2 emitter. And so, you know, you can think of it roughly as a fuel cell car running on hydrogen produces roughly as much CO2 as a car running on natural gas, regular car running on natural gas. They're in that ballpark. So when you have to pack a storage substance into something small like a car, you worry about the energy density. And gas, regular gasoline is... I tend to think in terms of kilowatt hours because it's just one way of expressing the amount of energy in something. You can use joules, BTUs, whatever. I like kilowatt hours. So gasoline is about 12.7 kilowatt hours per kilogram. And so we're used to that. That's what we put in our car tanks. Hydrogen is like 39. So it's very, very energy dense, but getting the kilogram of hydrogen isn't very dense. So a kilogram of hydrogen is very diffuse. You have to either compress it very heavily, usually done in tanks down to about 700 atmospheres, is a common kind of industrial and automotive classification that people know how to do, and it's safe, and you can mass produce these things. Or you can go ahead.
What would that be in PSI?
Let me see. 15 is about 10,000 pounds per square inch.
Wow. Roughly. Okay.
You know, so you wouldn't want to rupture these, and these tanks is what one of the things. Whenever you have a new technology, people get worried about them. Like we've seen a lot of concerns about electric vehicle fires and things like this. In the early days of cars burned all the time. One of the real innovations that GM came up with, partnering with MIT in the early 20s, was making fueling systems and fuel handling systems on board cars safe. That's one of the things that made cars practical. In fact, when I was going to school in Southern California, and way back when, whenever I would get on the freeway on 5, I would regularly see like an old VW bug by the side of the road burning. So we're used to these things. So these tanks are going to explode. It will probably be with a very low frequency and only associated with crashes. To first order, they're a safe technology. So we have hydrogen. We have this incredible energy density. When we compress it down, it turns out that even compressed, the amount of volume you need for a tank is about 15% a gas tank is 15% that of a hydrogen tank carrying equivalent energy. So figure a hydrogen tank has to be about 8 times larger to carry equivalent energy. And if you can liquefy it, you can cut that by a factor of 2, but handling liquid hydrogen is sort of iffy. BMW invested a lot of money looking into that, but that's not considered a viable route. So when we compare it to lithium-ion batteries, and, you know, they're kind of the batteries that you can recharge, they have the highest practical energy density. They're about 150 to 200 watts per kilogram, not kilowatts, watts. So 0.15 to 0.2 compared to the 12 point something for gasoline and 39 for hydrogen. I can throw in a couple of other comparisons just for fun. A really good ice cream, like a really good Ben and Jerry's, is about 3.5 kilowatt hours per kilogram. So, you know, it's 20 times better than a lithium-ion battery. And dynamite is about 1.3 Mm-hmm. So, you know, on the relative scale of things, there are problems with lithium ion batteries or any battery. But one of the things to consider, one of the important things to consider is, compared to the overall mass of a car, the mass of a battery is not huge. Even in a car like a Tesla, which packs enough battery to go about 250 miles, the overall mass of the battery, and it's kind of an extreme case, is about a quarter of that of the car. And so,
although that varies with temperature, I have to jump in because Fred has a Tesla in the colder climates, and while he loves it, doesn't like the 140, 130 mile limit during the dead of January.
That is point. And with any of these technologies, fuel cells and gasoline. So, gasoline, oil. Hydrocarbons are liquid hydrocarbons are this almost perfect fuel. They have this extremely high energy density. They're easy to handle. They're all over the earth. They're relatively cheap. They have really good temperature characteristics. All of these wonderful things, except when you burn them, they produce various types of pollution. They're distributed across the earth in such a way that there are often geopolitical problems associated
with them. Right, right. So, they're concentrated in the wrong places.
all of our oil is under their sand. It used to be the same. So all of these things have issues. And with batteries, I mean, every once in a while you'll hear a press release about this magic battery, but when it comes to a battery, it's how many charge cycles will it go? Can it hold up to vibration? What are its temperature characteristics? What is its cost? There are about six or eight variables that you're trying to optimize, and that's hard and progress is slow. And there are similar but different variables going on with fuel cells. And there's been a lot of billions of dollars of work on that too, less now than there was 5 and 10 years ago, but still huge amounts of work. You're dealing with a very entrenched, massive technology and infrastructure and coming up against it, essentially with an electric car with different types of fuel storage or energy storages, whereas the electric car had, assuming you can get energy to it, has enormous advantages over an internal combustion engine. So, you know, you see the seeds for some kind of a disruption, but now we're into the complexities, and I should probably stop and let Jim and Horace go on here for a while.
Well, thanks, Steve. It's amazing when you start to educate yourself about the subject, how many variables there are, and how the question of performance, right, what is better, comes up. And it's impossible to summarize it into one variable, right? It's not, we hear about range, but that's not the only variable. There are these questions around density and the end-to-end system. And it is a system we should be analyzing, all the way from how is the fuel source, step two, its distribution, and so on.
That's such an excellent point. I mean, the thing that attracts me to worrying about this and thinking about it is that cars are a complex system unto themselves. There are subsystems that are very complex, but they're embedded in all of these other systems, and all of these evolve at their own rate, and with their their own characteristic timescales, and they're all unsynchronized, and so that gives you just this horrible, it's not horrible, it's a fascinating problem. In physics, you refer to something called metastable states. And so, you know, you have this system, and you look at the subcomponents of it, and none of them are probably optimal. Maybe one out of 20 is or something, but, you know, they're all suboptimal, but they're all sort of working together. To change that overall system is extremely difficult, to find some new ordering of those individual states. And that's what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, that that's really that's exactly why I'm attracted as well to it, because it may not be obvious especially in the forum of public debate on the subject. It's fascinating how camps form, and you can see an obvious mistake, if you will, in the assumptions being made by all camps. Here's one to this point is, I think that this camp forming around electric vehicles as the future. Why is it, if that's the case, and this has been a puzzle for us here on ACM Car for a year, why is it that the incumbents are not rushing to copy Tesla? And there's several hypotheses. One is that they're all slow and dim-witted, and I just reject that because it's not an assumption you can make safely about one individual, and it's not an assumption you can make safely for the millions of people in that industry. So it's to me, that's unlikely. There might be some system-wide issues with speed of change, but those things get sorted if there's enough incentive for it to happen. And we just haven't seen a rush to electric vehicles, although maybe a rush is happening, we just don't sense it.
Yeah, if you look at the scale of Tesla, you know, it's very small compared to, unless you're in Norway or someplace mm-hmm. like that, where they're the dominant car, or the dominant new car for a couple of months, for some interesting reasons, which for all of these things also exist politically too,
and sure,
that's
sure.
an important thing. Let me see. I kind of lost my train of thought when
the first thing that you have to consider on volume and demand is, you know, why Tesla remains barely a niche. It's really how do you introduce the product to the market? You know, and right now, Tesla certainly is skimming.
Unless you're
in a certain geography.
So here is where I was going to go. So Tesla is producing this car that is, you know, it's even in its smallest form is over 2,000 kilograms, and it's very much an American car. I mean, it's this very huge thing that. It's very expensive. It appeals to a certain number of people, very relatively low number of people. The real niche that a lot of people see for electric cars, and we can get into why I think it's a niche, is a very much smaller car, which probably doesn't make a lot of sense in the United States or North America, and maybe much more appropriate in China and developing worlds.
Sorry to interrupt. I think, you know, we're getting into the question of demand and appeal, but I think the question is more about the why is it that manufacturers haven't rushed into the Tesla model, in the sense that there are these questions in my mind. And again, we started with hydrogen from Toyota. They're not alone. Along with Toyota, Hyundai. I believe Honda we already mentioned. They launched already, and Mercedes-Benz I think have made some commitment. And so these are not the dumb people in the industry, right? Toyota, arguably probably the smartest guys in the business. Mercedes. Probably, well, the longest in the business, but also, you know, they've had a technological core to their offering for a long time. Compared to BMW, for example, they're sort of seen as equals in the minds of sort of, you know, from a marketing point of view. Mercedes is actually a far bigger company, you know, involved in many forms of transport. BMW is mostly just sports cars and or sporty cars and motorcycles. So the idea that Mercedes is getting involved is very significant. And so that's, to me, the question is why are the smart guys in the room going with hydrogen? And in particular, the smartest, I think, from that point of view, because of Toyota, let's not forget, they introduced the Prius. The Prius,
in the mid-90s, it really was small for quite a while. Yeah.
It's a phenomenon. We cannot, I cannot overstate the Prius idea. They launched a product that nobody asked for. They launched a product that seemed to be completely uneconomical. Going around with two engines in your car, having to deal with complex control systems for that, having to deal with battery technology in the 90s, and putting it all together into a product that became a hit product that now is a significant portion of their volumes and profits.
Right, but that's an amazing 7 story. Years at least.
It did, and that's
to get any serious volume.
Yeah, but they made the commitment knowing that it takes 7 years.
Oh, absolutely, and the new fuel cell car from them appears to be very much the same thing.
In fact, it's led by the same person who started down the road with Prius. So it's a decision they're making now. I think with a 7 to 10 year roadmap. At least, or they've made it a few years ago. They must have made it a long time. In fact, the what I read about it is that they're working on these very tiny problems that are tiny to us but big to them. You know, in terms of getting efficiencies and improvements.
And in Japan, in particular, the government, up until a disaster a few years ago, was very much into the notion of the hydrogen economy. Now, that's gone now. There's a lot of flywheel effect from research projects going on and from development projects going on. But Japan was interesting in the sense that there was so much of a push to a hydrogen economy there.
Yeah. Okay, now we have to think, this I'm not aware of, but we have to think about the political causes behind it. But I think that the company, so this is why I'm intrigued by it. I always like to study, you know, I just posted the disruption FAQ. At the end of the day, what I boiled it down to is the question, is there asymmetry? Is there a... is an entrant coming into the market in a way that is so different but yet profitable that allows them to stay in that market long enough to unseat an incumbent? And in this case, when you're looking at can the industry be disrupted, you're looking at an entrant like Tesla, and you're saying, well, are they sufficiently asymmetric? And the test would be that the incumbents either laugh at it and dismiss the entry, or they embrace it. And if they embrace it, it's not good news because Tesla doesn't make it. But if they ignore it, then it might be good news because then they can keep going. And here we're having a situation with hydrogen where perhaps hydrogen becomes something that the incumbents are willing to embrace somehow, for whatever reason. We don't know. It's hundreds of variables.
Right.
For some combination of those variables that this actually works better for them. And this is what I'm asking. And then the battle becomes that the incumbents run with hydrogen, and then they still swamp the newcomer sufficiently that asymmetry is not going to lead to disruption. So that's where I'm puzzling over this. And I'm love to hear your opinion on what's going on with hydrogen. And I, by the way, sorry to keep going, but the thing that attracts me about hydrogen, and I saw a segment on the Clarity done by James May of Top Gear, where essentially they conclude that's the future because of the way the system conforms, using hydrogen as a consumer, conforms to the gasoline model.
Go ahead.
No, so that's my point is that it is very conformable, so it seems like there isn't a giant leap in our behavior that has to change. So
that's a really important point. I've driven a Clarity, and it's very much like a regular car. Until you have to fill it up, and when I had to fill it up, and this was because it was very early, when I filled it up, I filled it up at a station which could make about 10 kilograms of hydrogen per day, and the price per kilogram was about $19. Now, so a couple of notes on this. A kilogram of hydrogen is roughly the equivalent in energy of a gallon of gasoline. They're very close. So I was paying nearly about $19 a gallon for gasoline in a station that could supply about the equivalent of 10 gallons of gasoline a day. And the station cost $8 million to build. Now, they've improved that. There's been a lot of work on that. The goal is to be able to build a station that can produce 100 kilograms of hydrogen a day for about $2 million. And you need, so the question is, how many stations do you need per car when you deploy it? And depending on, you know, the frequency of how people, you can imagine everybody on weekends going in and looking for gas or something like this. And the rules of thumb work out to 200 to 500 cars per station like this. So if they can bring it down to the $2 million for building a station, this is the California goal, by the way, that's an infrastructure cost of about $10,000 per car. And this is not like the land cost of building a station. This is finding someone who has land. This is what the equipment costs, the refueling equipment and the electrolysis equipment. California is saying, look, we want to do it with electrolysis. We don't want CO2 coming from this. And it's kind of impractical to ship around the hydrogen to a station, although you can do it. So there are these really interesting infrastructure costs that get.
But the thing with infrastructure, and this is again, I'm gonna play both sides of the debate here. But the thing with infrastructure costs is that they're daunting when you look at it from the beginning of a cycle, a build out cycle. But then when you realize that scale economies come into play,
I fully agree, and we're sitting on top of this 100 years of build out of oil infrastructure. So
yeah, exactly.
So you have to see where these, and you know, there's a problem with electricity infrastructure too, and in fact,
I like to refer to the telecom networks here because that's the same thing. If you looked at the in year 2000, if you looked ahead and said, can we deliver mobile broadband to individuals so that they can stream Netflix to their phones, that would have been ridiculous. In fact, it would have been ridiculous to think of Netflix on landline networks. But what we ended up with is, in short order, we ended up with very reliable and quite a lot of bandwidth.
Well, you know, in the late 80s, when AT&T made the decision to get – I was in Bell Labs at the time – when AT&T made the decision to get out of wireless, because there will never be more than – and there were several studies. They usually ran between, you know, low millions of numbers of people in the world who will ever have a cell phone. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make sense. Meanwhile, within in Bell Labs – people were asking questions, gee, what do we do about 2010 when the number of cell phones in the world is roughly equal to when you have a half cell phone per person in the world? Mm-hmm. So you know, there were these very out of sync.
That's why smart people who do studies early on in a cycle would usually throw up a lot of objections. And this is the thing, is that, you know, I don't know, there's a lot of sayings about people rolling up their sleeves and getting it done and so on and so on. And so I'm not willing to accept, that the technology will not make it on the basis of a lot of studies.
I hear you. And what's needed early on, I guess my point is that someone has to come up with this small boatload of money. Mm-hmm. So, like when Toyota comes out with their car, it will probably cost less to the consumer. You'll get credits in some countries and like Hyundai is now selling a few hydrogen cars in Southern California, but when you buy them, you get free gas or free hydrogen.
So there are
these things which have to be in the market to normalize things for a while until they can fade. And the question is, can you scale to a point where you can get rolling enough? And you're much better at understanding this than I am.
But isn't it leadership? I mean, what you're talking about in Toyota's case is having the foresight, the institutional foresight, the leadership on top.
Sure. Spend
the money and see it through. You know, in AT&T's case, they had the investment back in the 90s, and you know, all the ideas were there, but they just killed
it.
Right?
Yeah, you've got to have the resources to do it, and this is where politics come in. Like China has made the decision, hydrogen doesn't win. We're going with batteries, and they have the weight of
right. Well, but they've changed. They've also said in the past that they're going to go with their own homegrown standards for wireless networking and so on.
Absolutely.
But I think they've actually one thing that's not known about China is that they've made over the years thousands of decisions in terms of standards, but they're all seen as experiments, and so they're very quick to shut down ideas as well as create new ones. So that's one thing
when I talk to Chinese folks who study this about it, the difference in efficiency between hydrogen as storage and just doing it in a battery is so much that's their driver. They need that difference in efficiency.
Well, that's again the technical discussion, and I buy it, but a lot of technology discussions, you know.
I agree with you. I'm just saying that there's this fairly enormous factor, and that's what they're.
Back to this other framing of the problem is sort of like incumbent versus entrant, and Jim, you mentioned leadership. I think you're right that leadership's needed, but again, we have leadership on both camps. We have leadership going on, a proof of leadership in terms of some of the smart incumbents going in one direction, and then some of the smart entrants like Elon Musk going in another direction. So there's no shortage of intelligence and leadership in this business. How is it going to play out is when you have to look at the system-wide issues of what trumps what. There are a lot of bad technology ended up deployed widely. And then there's, I'll give you another example. I don't know if I've mentioned this before. But the Volkswagen Bug is actually a very bad design on many, many dimensions.
Yes, I saw them in California.
they're burning it. And Model T had a lot of design flaws as well. And both were huge hits. And I think arguably there are many product categories when you look at the leading product that made it big, just to see just how poor the quality and design. Windows was a very poor design.
Distribution power there and leadership again, because they had the ability to crush the competition.
The conditions come together to allow that to happen, so that the conditions overwhelm the technological flaws.
Yeah. So here's one of the things that I'm really interested in is, you know, we have this huge incumbency in Europe and the United States and arguably Japan too, with regular, gasoline or diesel powered vehicles, and we're seeing an electrification of those vehicles, and people. There's this inertia. People don't want to change. And, you know, you can talk about various niches and things like this, commuter cars and little cars and things like this. I'm interested in the parts of the world where a lot of these systems really are poorly developed or are still developing. So when you're building out a city, what is the architecture and geometry of that city? And what are average commutes? And what kind of electric systems or pipelines for carrying hydrogen or whatever are you going to put in? What does a car mean? What does sharing, there are some wild cards we haven't mentioned, like self-driving cars and shared cars, which might have impact on range anxiety or not. You know, maybe you want a car that has an enormous amount of fuel capacity to handle that. So there are these. To me, what's going on or what might go on in 10 years in the rest of the world is more interesting than what's going on in the United States.
Absolutely. So there's this issue of sort of local phenomena as well. Although I've seen many places also which seem to be running
right now China is building out very American cities, and the few new cities which are emerging in Africa are very American. I mean,
or maybe they're emulating Dubai or something like that.
When I mentioned that, there's a book I've mentioned a few books. There's a in the past there's a really excellent book by a guy named Jeff Speck, who's an urban architect and urban planner, called The Walkable City. And he goes into it's kind of like counterpoint to Earl Swift's The Big Roads. It kind of goes into how cities develop and why certain car ranges are needed and how transportation systems develop. And in trying to understand this globally, it's really interesting and excellent counterpoint. No solution. I mean, he definitely has a message that he's trying to get apart, but independent from that, it gives a person a lot to think about. It, in my mind, when I read it, it raised an entirely new set of interesting questions. So recommend it.
Right. So just let's revisit this question again. What I'm struggling with again is that hydrogen may seem technologically inferior to battery-based technology, and there are a lot of issues with it. But I still am wondering why it might. And you mentioned that not only are some automakers excited about it, some political camps excited about it, but also perhaps the fuel lobby and the fuel.
The only comment I make on that is it's inferior and superior to electricity, depending on the angle that you come from, which is what you're saying.
So the superiority is evident only in that some major incumbents are willing to embrace and it sustains them. That sustaining power may be sufficient to blunt the disadvantages.
I think, and also, I mean, Toyota's been praised for all of their efforts pushing it. An even bigger contribution was made by the Department of Energy in the United States from about 1995 until 2008. The funding for hydrogen research and development was huge, and GM probably more work on hydrogen was done at GM and Ford than Toyota. And, you know, to take it from the level where you're talking about thousands of dollars per watt, or per kilowatt, down many thousands of dollars per kilowatt down.
Let me take it from another angle now. The one issue that we keep coming back to as a mark against hydrogen is efficiency, and that it costs a lot. Now, what if the future is a little bit different than we imagine it? And meaning that right now what we think of as energy is, you know, the energy is quite expensive, and that So there's two elements to energy consumption. One, it's the capture of that energy, and the two is its distribution, which includes storage. So hydrocarbon-based fuel is fairly expensive to dig up, but fairly cheap to store, and ship around. Now, electrical power that might go into vehicles might end up being very cheap to produce, because if we're using photovoltaic or wind energy, there are places in the world where both of those are in a glut situation. There's more production than consumption. So if that glut situation were to spread and become a worldwide phenomenon, we'd be sitting on a huge amount of production and no way to get it into your tank. And so as opposed to hydrocarbon, a renewable model might be the opposite: very cheap to produce and very expensive to store and distribute. And so grids don't work well. The grid that we have today is assuming essentially baseload of production, and that's not the way wind comes in or sun. And so you'd have to go to another form of storage, and this gets into the whole debate about how to do it on an industrial scale, and there are many things.
This is the central problem, and it's for baseload type production. It's not as much of a problem, but it's still a problem. I mean, storage is still important there, and for these intermittent sources, it's kind of funny. I've looked fairly deeply into the Danish problem. If you look at Jutland, they're Denmark is covered with wind, and they've, due to a certain company there, they've built an enormous assemblage of wind turbines in Jutland and so forth. And so they have this surplus. I mean, in a way, they're like Hawaii, where there's kind of a beginning to be a surplus in solar. They have a huge, huge surplus in wind. And they use Norway as a battery, which is kind of strange. The notion is they sell most of their wind energy to Norway and at whatever rate. And Norway has all of this hydroelectric power. And so what they're effectively doing is preventing Norway from running the water through the dams when the wind's blowing. And then they buy energy from Norway, hydropower, to make up for it. So it's this, it's a really interesting wind storage.
Exactly.
System. And it's done economically and with some undersea cables. And you can do that with hydrogen and with or batteries on a level, or just distributing around the grid.
Let me play at the scenario. Let's extrapolate the scenario, because it's a fascinating one. This is exactly the asymmetry. You have a new technology, which is a renewable, coming from an unreliable source, sun and wind, and allows you to sort of completely invert the economic equation. And so you don't worry about production anymore. Someone pointed out that if you just covered a very tiny fraction of the Sahara Desert with solar panels, you're going to supply the whole world. Yeah. The problem is how to get it to the right person.
Yep.
Right?
So wires are hard.
Yeah. Yes. So let's assume. Let me play the scenario. If you have an abundance, and I mean, 2x what you need in terms of production, why not waste it? We squander that which is abundant, and we hoard that which is scarce. So this is just an axiom of economics. So imagine if you were to have overproduction. The production of solar panels and the production of wind turbines works on different cycles than the pattern of consumption. In other words, the way that ends up rolling out. And so the incentives often are to overproduce. This is why the semiconductor industry gets whipsawed so much, is that you build these expensive plants and then you gotta keep them running. And so people tend to make commitments when demand is seen as to be unmet. But then once those commitments are fulfilled, the demand is way, way lower. So you have this issue that the situation could come up where right now we're dealt with photovoltaics. Photovoltaics are getting prices are getting all over the place because the overcapacity has been created. So economics works in funny ways that you get to a situation where you might have overcapacity, and if you do, then we're going to have, let's say, more than we need in terms of potential electrical power. Why not waste it through electrolysis, which we just determined is very uneconomical? Yeah, but it's very uneconomical given the current assumptions about the grid. And so if compression and all those other losses that go into the hydrogen system would be born out because, we have all this lying around, all this energy that's sort of coming in.
This was kind of the Japanese model for the hydrogen economy. They thought they would have very inexpensive nuclear reactors eventually, and that the demand, the power demand from businesses and homes during the day ramps up and down by about a factor of 3 or 4, and so by since the power would be cheap by not throttling the reactors right. as much, they would have all of this available for electrolysis.
But let me just play out the scenario a bit further. That it's not that was based on assumptions about nuclear, but let's make
it
other
works
assumptions.
The same, yeah.
Yeah. If you have countries today that are abundant in solar, insulation or solar radiation is abundant, they might deploy, for whatever economic incentives, deploy solar. If they had a way to package the results and ship it north somewhere where there isn't so much sun. But if that were the way the game is played, that would be a real disruption, because then you would have the ability to sort of collect sunshine into bottles of hydrogen. And bottles meaning, of course, some very highly compressed a container that is, transportable. Some sort of, I suppose there are standards for this now that you can safely transport hydrogen industrially, and so you imagine a scenario where actually this is possible because the overabundance of solar would allow it. The alternative, which is I think the model that's foreseen by Tesla, would be that you package solar into lithium ion batteries with the building of a gigafactory. Now, to me, that is feasible, but not scalable to the same degree that the hydrogen model would be. And so this is where we have to, you have a fork in the road, right? You have a vision of the future that goes in two directions, and that's where anyway, go on. Sorry.
You have to build a lot of factories. That's, which things can, choices can be made. Who knows? But I was just thinking as you were saying that, there's a lot of sunlight. Most life on Earth, the fact that we're around, we're driven by sunlight. The food we eat and the fuel we burn is all just stored sunlight. There's this process called photosynthesis, which is enormously inefficient. It's just, 1 or 2% efficient at best. And basically, part of that is very similar to electrolysis. It's splitting the hydrogen out of the water and making it available.
And exactly.
And it's enormously inefficient, but heavens, we have.
But it's effective. You see, this is where I draw the line between efficiency and effectiveness. Effectiveness,
absolutely.
It wins when you got to get something done.
When I work out food crops, their efficiency in turning sunlight into useful energy to store it is about 0.3%. So, you can look at a tree sitting on the road next to you. You can say, how many watts is that tree? And that's an interesting calculation.
So life in nature in general doesn't work on efficiency basis. It works on the basis of getting it done, staying alive. And it squanders and hoards way that we do as economic animals.
I mean, it's this wonderful mental stable state. There are areas where the efficiencies, there are parts of efficient photosynthesis that are enormously, photosynthesis turns out to be fairly complex. There are parts of it that are enormously efficient and can only be explained quantum mechanically, like high 90%. But it assembled something through happenstance that just works, and it doesn't care that it sucks.
Exactly. So do we care? Do we care if hydrogen, quote, sucks as an efficiency?
If energy is free, and it doesn't suck that much in the fact that there's a factor of 1.6 to a regular battery. If you look at fossil fuels, if you burn them, you're doing really well to get up to efficiencies around 40%, whereas with hydrogen fuel cells, 50-55%, if you're in the right range is practical, so that's good. And, we shouldn't complain as people. One of the fun things I did was try to work out the efficiency of a bicycle rider and by making tests. and measuring metabolism and all of that, it turns out when you move your muscles, your efficiency for turning food, the hydrocarbons in your food, into motion, it's about 25%. It's roughly the same as your car. Hydrogen is damn good compared to fossil fuels.
So you see, what we're coming up to is this question that systems, complex systems, economic, business, and so on are not always the most efficient outcome, but it works, and often once something works, everybody piles on, and that becomes rigid and unchanging, and that's how actually we have the systems we have today, and so when predicting the future of a complex system, we have to differentiate between efficient and effective. The efficient may be ideal, but the effective wins. And so where this might go, and I think maybe the sense of it is, I don't know if the incumbents planning on hydrogen are doing so because they foresee the whole system, or whether it just works for them in a selfish way. They're just taking care of number one. But in longer term, if you coalesce all of these less than efficient systems into one, because they're all, like you said, subsystems, then what you end up with is an outcome that a lot of people won't like, but it will actually work and scale to the point where everybody has this type of vehicle.
And we might have a lot of regional differences too. I mean, even...
Brings up another point. The interesting thing about the auto industry is just how homogeneous it became globally. How little difference there is between local economies. There was much more in the past. I mean, we would have European cars that wouldn't work in the U.S. and vice versa. And now more or less we have similar taste, quote unquote, sort of technological taste, not necessarily aesthetic taste. But we do have this sort of common standard. Now, and that's true in technology and clothing and so on. But my question is then, would we get a sort of different tastes locally growing, developing, because the conditions will not apply? One thing we've railed on in this show is how there hasn't been a production method that has appeared to combat or to contrast or to compete with the dominant production method in the automobile industry, to the point where even Tesla as an entrant chose the exact same production system everyone else had, even though their scale is so much smaller, and it makes sense to go to a different standard when you're small. So it's this whole, there's this incumbency in the inertia. And so perhaps if we have a renewable source of power, then some regions will find it economical to sort of develop a system for transportation that is entirely local sourced. So what I mean is, because you have improvements in the capture and storage of energy, then you might actually say, well, it makes sense for us to produce vehicles locally in a different way, and therefore we might go to a composites with the modular design, right, rather than the integrated system we have today, and so on and so on. That's again another discussion, maybe for another day. But it's a wonderful...
It is such a wonderful, amazing problem. And you know, I share your frustration, and this is why I get slightly interested in... I'm starting to follow Africa much more and getting depressed, you know, with hope and depression, but both based on that. And it's...
Africa is fascinating, because actually Africa would be the perfect home for an energy... disruption because of the asymmetry there.
I keep wondering if Gordon Murray has ever talked to anybody there, but that's a pipe dream.
It's funny because he is from Africa originally.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
No, there's food for thought here going for many more shows. We're running a bit long on time, but
I do want to add two things that came in that were in the auto news in the last couple of days. One was that to your point about sustaining the model we have. You know, BMW has announced apparently they're going to build another factory in the U.S. For one and three series and minis, which is interesting to me that, that they're also talking to Tesla about various joint ventures at the same time. So that, I think, is one data point.
So BMW might go more into the electric camp. That's true. Certainly, with the i-series, they've made that
BMW and Audi is pushing towards that. But, you know, these are expensive cars.
Well, exactly. And then, you know, the other thing is the thinking about the regulation in the developed world, let's say developed world.
Regulation? What's that?
Well, right. You know, Dan Neal did an interesting article on these sort of mutating off-road cars that can go up to 75 miles an hour that they're not really cars, I guess. They're four-wheelers, but, you know, they have a lot of features. But his point was these things are getting better and better, and so you look at these different use cases. And then there was another article that I think relates to this whole issue last night in Bloomberg about millennials in the U.S. Shunning malls. And, you know, Horace, we've talked about, you know, Google self-driven cars or autonomous cars in the past and the incentive to shop and all that. And obviously, as use cases for traditional cars continue to decline, you know, maybe these things push the bigger game a bit. And so, yeah, there's plenty of – it's a fertile territory for further discussion. And we've covered a good bit of ground on lithium versus hydrogen.
In fact, I'm afraid, and when I think back on our – just this chat of whether we have actually answered some of the questions.
There's one thing that I just want to add that's interesting. You know, people talk about peak whatever. You know, there's been peak oil and whatever. What that generally means is what is the point at which I mean, there's a formal definition, but the informal working definition is, well, you know, there's usually a lot of stuff and you can keep looking at a higher price. And so how much is the market willing to bear? There was a lot of work done or a bit of work done about 7 or 8 years ago on lithium and the world supply of it. And it turns out that the amount of lithium in a battery is about 0.1% of the cost. But the cost, because people are starting to use much more lithium, is really starting to go up. Batteries used to represent about 10% of world production of lithium. Now it's about 30%. So it's priced.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just the lithium debate. I've said, and I've been caught on record saying that there isn't enough lithium in the world to supply. But anyway, go on.
Well, the latest work on it appears that there is a lot of lithium, and it's just a question of how much you're willing to pay.
Exactly.
And where it comes from, if you're willing to go as 5 times the current price, which would make it, if batteries end up costing about 1/3 as much as they do now and price goes up 5 times, that would mean about 1.5% of the cost of the battery would be lithium. There's a very, very large supply from seawater. So you know, it's like oil. If you're willing to pay $400 a barrel for oil, you know, it will go more than 100 years. So, and with batteries, there's also an issue, you know, how much cobalt is there in the world? And with fuel cells, there's a platinum issue. And so all of these things have these little things that get in the way that can cause economic hiccups as they scale.
Well, we've covered a good bit of ground today, and we certainly have continued our exploration on ASIMCAR. So, Steve and Horace, thanks for your time this morning, and we will look forward to chatting again soon.
Well, thank you much, and unfortunately, I'll be out to fill up my car again today.